Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Jim and Austin. I thought today that we might talk a little bit about what has happened in Israel and Gaza. As normal, we don't normally jump on something right away and focus on it because of our approach to the news. And now that we've had some time to digest it and see what's going on and like that, it's time to hear from the two of you. So, Jim, what do you think is going to happen with the ceasefire and where things sit? And then I'll ask you a question about Iran after we finish up
with
that.
First of all, technically, it's not a ceasefire. I forget if there's an Arab phrase for it, but it means pause. You know, it's lower than a ceasefire. And it implies that the fighting will resume. Now, the Arabs, the Palestinians will, if you press them on this, they'll say, well, we're always at war with Israel. And all you have to do is look at their web pages, even the English versions, and they all they talk about is, you know, this Hamas says, you know, we're here to destroy Israel. Actually, The Fatah is saying the same thing. They're not as strident, and if pressed in public, they'll say, well, we're willing to make peace with Israel, but, you know, they've been pretty much exposed as, you know, double dealers by now. But they'll still do it. The problem is, the Hamas did not expect, that Israel would go ballistic on it. They thought they could keep firing the missiles. You know, this has been getting worse and worse. I mean, there were like close to 400 rockets and mortar shells fired into Israel in the month before, you know, the latest war, as it were. The last thing the Israelis warned them, Hamas, was that if you don't, you know, crack down, we're going to start going after your leaders again, which they've done before and done a lot of damage. And this, of course, gets the attention of the leadership because it's very personal. If someone says, we're going to kill you if you don't, you know, do something. But as we also explained, Hamas is facing another problem in Gaza in that the smaller terrorist organizations are not so small anymore, and it's turned into a game of who's more radical than thou. Hamas, you know, basically was a victim of be careful what you wish for, you might get it, you know, when they thought, hey, it'd be great to, you know, be elected to be in charge of Gaza. And now they find that, you know, nobody likes them in Gaza or elsewhere because running the place is not, you know, what it was as easy as it looked to be. And at the same time, you got all these other more militant Islamic radical groups saying, you know, we're not paying any attention to any ceasefire you weaklings, you know, have negotiated with Israel. We're going to keep attacking. I mean, it's totally insane. But, you know, as one Israeli state pointed out years ago, the Palestinians never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. You know, I mean, the history of the Palestinians, you know, since Israel became a country, it's been one mistake after another. I mean, they backed Islamic terrorism, they backed Saddam Hussein, they're backing, you know, the destruction of Israel or nothing. They'll settle for nothing less. And of course, there are groups in the West now who support them, who say, oh, yes, you're victims, you know, and you're blameless, and all those terrible Nazi Israelis. You know, the world is a strange place. This latest war with, you know, Hamas was more theater than anything else. I mean, the Israelis feel with some justification that they won, but so what? The Hamas declared, you know, the day of the pause, the ceasefire, whatever you want to call it, took place, is now a national holiday, which is, you know, it's theater. You know, I mean, this goes back to Saddam Hussein or best of all, Saddam Hussein's, you know, information minister, standing outside, you know, just before the Baghdad was captured, saying, oh, the Americans are nowhere near the Baghdad. And in the background, you could see, you know, American M1 tanks on the other side of the river. You know, I mean, this sort of thing plays itself out again and again. Now, I know a lot of Arabs. Now, these are educated Wall Street type Arabs, but they're embarrassed by this. you know, they're like talking about their idiot cousins, which actually that phrase was used once and then retracted. They don't know what they can do, because in the Islamic world, you really cannot criticize anybody who is doing something based upon religion or nationalism, because, you know, the Islam preaches that we're all part of one big happy family. And of course, religion, technically speaking, you know, cannot be criticized, because they still put people to death for blasphemy and, for all sorts of religious, oriented, misbehavior. The people in the Arabs in, who are educated, who have good jobs, who have, a certain degree of, of freedom, they feel they can't stop it. And this is the whole problem in a nutshell. Everybody agrees it's a mess, but nobody agrees on what the hell you can do about it. And there we are.
Austin, your take on
it? I think Jim's very practical and elegant, because it's very simple explanation of why the "I'm more radical than thou" is such a plague in Arab society. Is there's nothing to add to it. In fact, as Jim, I think I'm going to steal it. Use it again. It does come down to the notion of the of notion of faith and pan Islamism, and that we're all quote unquote all the same based on the religious faith, and the extremists leverage that, and that's they're acting on that accord. Of course, they're not, and everybody knows it, but the situation is such that particularly in these enclaves, chaotic enclaves, and they are chaotic. I'm using Gaza as an example, the West Bank to a lesser degree, Lebanon, many enclaves of many different types of chaos. That is the ideological power. That's one of the. It's a means of providing an ideology for the maintenance of power, a dictatorial, violent brand of power. I'm going to take off on another tack, Dan. Something Jim did mention: the Israelis think they won. I think the Israelis won in terms of knocking back Iran's latest investment in rockets and flying IEDs from Gaza. I think that was part of the intent, and also, as Jim mentioned, putting some personal fear into the introducing or in raising the level of personal fear among Hamas's leaders. You're going to be held personally responsible, because you are personally responsible for these relentless attacks on these Israeli towns. I think the Israelis put up with it in October for a number of reasons. I think the U.S. presidential election certainly factored into their political calculations. Also, they reach a certain number. Jim mentioned several hundred. I read 400 plus rockets in October. So that's, there's a show that they were getting, 15 a day at a minimum or so. That's a lot of rocket fire. We're not going to put up with it anymore. And they took the action. Now, where does that leave us? It leaves us with the same old, and preparation for another round. Because last week, you have to take some of these wire service articles with several grains of salt and quinine, grain alcohol sometimes, that Iran was already shipping new supplies of barrage rockets to Hamas. I believe it. I believe they try to do it all the time. Interceptions are made. To some degree, the Israelis have in the past, we'll get to Egypt here in a minute, I know, but have had some cooperation with the Egyptians on shutting down some of the sources of supply through Sinai. But then you have multiple sources of supply. We didn't really address this, but in late October, the Yarmouk factory area in Khartoum received a visit, a night visit from air raiding from air, aircraft, bombers, and a ammunition factory blew up, and the word was that it was Israeli aircraft taking out a factory that was either putting rocket motors onto rockets or also fixing them with warheads, and they were in Sudanese in Khartoum in league with the Iranians on it. Factory, lots and lots of sympathetic detonations, and there was even a few cell phone photos taken by local residents of Khartoum. So these Israelis take action to intercept and interdict when they can. Constant war, and like I said, get ready for the next round, except this round really hadn't faded. It's just there's not live shooting too much going on around Gaza right now. It's that the war's shifted to trying to stop Iranian resupply.
Right. And that seems to be the difficult thing. The Israelis, the IDF, were putting out quite a few videos of some of their surgical strikes. And we've got some of them posted up on Strategy Page. It's pretty amazing how surgical they were. It's also amazing to watch them hit an area that looks like farmland, and it actually starts having secondary explosions because they're hiding the missiles underground.
Oh, there's some very clever, very, very clever deception tactics and camouflage being used.
So. Right. They had that one of the videos that we've got up is that the Hamas had put one of their launching sites in front of a mosque, and the Israelis were actually able to take it out without doing any visible damage to the mosque. I'm sure it took some superficial damage from shrapnel and like that, but overall it didn't seem to have harmed it much. The problem is, Jim, is the Iranians have been trying to ship larger and larger missiles into the Gaza area. Is that correct?
Yeah, they've been sending the Fajr missiles, the Fajr 3, which weighs about half a ton. It has a range of about 40 kilometers. And then the Fajr 5, which weighs about a ton and has a range of about 70 kilometers. And what they do is they ship them in pieces. These were apparently the containers that the Israelis bombed in Sudan. They kept them through the tunnels. You know, they basically bribed their way through Egypt and in up to the Gaza border in Egypt, and then basically move them through the tunnels, and then they have Iranian advisors helping them, instructing them on how to reassemble them into the complete missiles, because these things are like, you know, 20 feet, you know, 6 meters long when they're finished. And then, of course, they got to hide them somewhere and hope that the Israelis are not spotting, because the Israelis are not going to tell you until a war comes along. It's still unknown how many of those missiles, both the Fajrs and the longer range, they have the old 122-millimeter Russian missiles, the BM-21s, and there's an extended range version which goes for 40 kilometers that is less accurate than the Fajrs. The Fajrs are not that accurate. They'll land, you know, within 500 to 1,000 meters of the aiming point, which is pretty, you know, accurate at 70 kilometers. The big question mark is when are the Iranians going to start sending them the GPS guided ones? These are a little more complex. You got to be a little more careful assembling them, but you know, it's nothing that, you know, the Palestinians can't take care of. You got to remember about 85% of the population in Gaza is basically on welfare, being supported by the UN, or, for the most part, the American taxpayer. So they have plenty of people who are educated, you know, not much else to do. You know, they could probably handle it. Now, the only problem that will present to the Israelis is they're going to have to use more of their, Iron Dome, you know, Tamir missiles to knock these things down because they'll calculate that they're headed for, you know, a populated area. But this is a problem that the Israelis have to face. The Iranians want to send more and more. And this is probably why this isn't really making it in the news in a big way, but the Israelis let it be known that their satellites, and they have several photo spy satellites going over Iran, that they had spotted an Iranian ship being loaded with missile parts, as it were, and that they would keep an eye on this ship. The implication being that if it got close to the entrance of the Red Sea and got close to Sinan, they would sink it. Now, this would be an escalation, because in the past, they have not sunk Iranian ships. But it makes sense. I mean, if they're firing, if these are missiles that are going to end up being fired at Jerusalem and Tel Aviv and killing Israelis, you know, what would you do? And of course, what the Israelis are worried about is this becoming a cause celebre within Israel, the media making a big, which actually to a certain extent the media already is making a big thing of it. Well, hey, if we can spot these ships, why aren't we sinking them? Why do we have to wait for them to get unloaded in Sudan and then bomb the place where they're being stored before a truck can pick them up and take them up into Egypt? So this war is going to escalate, and I think the Israelis believe that it's more in their interest to escalate it far, far away from Israel. So I think we're going to see the war with Hamas moving to the Red Sea.
Well, let's talk about how that operation might be carried off. Jim, you don't think that they would immediately try to sink a submarine or an air tank? Don't you think that they would try to put the naval commandos on board first to show what it is they've got and then take some photos?
Well, that's a tricky situation. The naval commandos, you take a big risk. First of all, it's a major operation for them to get them down there. Especially get them down there stealthily. I mean, that would mean sending them out on submarines. Now, I don't know I don't believe they've sent one of their submarines through the Suez Canal since Mubarak, you know, left office, because that would be a risky proposition. I mean, politically, not that they would lose the submarine. But, you know, they would have to send their guys most likely down on fast surface craft. And that exposes them to all sorts of stuff. I mean, not that the Somali pirates would be a major, you know, problem. I suspect that if they were going to do it, while it would be safer politically and diplomatically, et cetera, to put people aboard that ship and confirm, you know, take pictures, aha, you know, and then just basically, you know, put the crew off in lifeboats and then just, you know, blow up the ship, it'd be a lot safer. And the Israelis are very fairly fanatical about this. You're not risking the lives of Israelis in these operations to simply, you know, bomb it and then take photos, you know, of the secondary explosions and wring your hands about, oh, it's terrible about the Iranian crew, but, you know, they're carrying munitions, you know, headed for Gaza to be fired into Israel. So what are we supposed to do? You know, we're at war. You know, people, it's easy for people to say, you know, oh, it's atrocious what the Israelis are doing, but if they were firing missiles at your neighborhood, it would, you know, there'd be a certain attitude adjustment.
Right.
Well, now, there's a follow-up discussion here, and that is that I've had this sense, and of course it's a sense, it's highly subjective, but I'm not the only one that's had this thought that the Israelis have become less concerned about whatever international opinion is or global reaction. Some of it has to do with the daily attacks suffered by the rocket attacks, that component, but also the quote-unquote same old reaction. No matter what we do or what we say, we're still faced with, as to get back to the first segment, Jim pointing out, you know, I'm more radical than thou, and there's always somebody else if there's a movement to some compromise, the hardline or harder line radicals crop up. But as wise as what I suggested, putting on naval commandos and taking photos, as and Jim mentioning, of course, that's what we do. Aha, they're caught. As wise as that is, and as how that fits into answers some pertinent, sure to be asked diplomatic questions, and the photo evidence, and perhaps a captured captured Iranian sailor as well, testifying as to what was on board, warrants some of the propaganda attacks. They reach a point of where, why bother? And that's kind of what Jim was leading towards. They've reached this point. Some of it has to do with their, I think, exemplified in their short war with Hamas this month. We'll stop when we feel we've accomplished whatever it is we've accomplished. I believe they've got a target list, and a certain number of those targets are hit and verify that they are destroyed. That has something to do with when the Israelis are going to agree to a ceasefire. Again, there's some indication out there that we know they do that, but that's whether that's leads. I'm not saying it's the only reason for ceasefire, but they've accomplished certain tactical and operational goals, and it's let's call a halt to the fighting and not pay another political price. But you could see that what Jim described, just flat out, we just sunk it. And we take pictures of the flotsam on the surface, and you've made a statement. Now, you've made a statement that Tehran will understand, whether the international media, the European media, understands it or not. So far, they have a few glimpses of this reality from the Israelis, but that may be what they're moving at. Jim, any response to that?
Well, exactly, and the Israelis have a lot of options with this sort of thing. For example, they could radio the ship, and even if the ship wasn't listening, I mean, there are various subterfuges. The Israelis are very good with the electronic warfare, and tell them, you have 30 minutes to get on the lifeboats and get clear of the ship. We're going to sink it, and we're going to sink it because you're carrying weapons. Now, that, hell, you could do it. You could do it live. Well, the Red Sea. What are they going to do? And you could have a UAV or whatever taking live video, showing here. Right, here's the Israelis, you know, broadcasting the message, you know, and then here's the live. Here's the audio of the Iranians responding. Because, you know, I wouldn't put it past the Iranians to put women and children on these ships, you know, just as tourists going to Sudan, that beautiful, you know, tourist attraction. To challenge the Israelis. But the Israelis saying, hey, look, you're being warned. You get off. Hit the lifeboats, baby, because that ship is not going to be there in 30 minutes. So there's any number of ways they can play it. You're right, Austin. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I'm just going to say on strategy page, Dan, you don't just get the strategic overview. You get operational guidance as well.
Well, yeah, but see, the Israelis have to face the fact, as Austin pointed out, that they can't win with the international media. They are the designated bad guys, and there's nothing other than them folding up their tents, literally, so to speak, and disappearing. That will change that with many of the critics. And, of course, the Israelis are the bad guys because this grabs the most headlines. You know, describing the situation as it really is a snooze fest. Because it's these Palestinians going with this crazy, you know, Israelis must be destroyed at yada yada. I mean, my God, to report on what's on those Arabic language websites is a real turnoff. You know, it'll turn your stomach. And so nobody's really going to touch
it. Really vile. It's vile.
Exactly. So nobody's going to touch it. It's not newsworthy. But accusing the Israelis, who everybody knows are fairly civilized, it's a working democracy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, are the real bad guys, that gets people's attention. The Israelis have to deal with internal politics. Because they are a democracy, no matter what they say in Europe or in Washington or the UN or whatever, the Israeli government is elected. And if they don't respond to what the Israeli people want, for example, not being bombarded by all these missiles, they're going to be out of office. And that's why the current government of Israel is considered by the West and everybody else as being a bunch of, you know, hardline conservatives. Well, hey, if you were being bombed, you know, regularly, wouldn't you be a hardline conservative in terms of defense? And that's where
Dan, you've got a perfect segue here in the discussion of Egypt about elections and elected heads of states here.
Yeah.
Exactly. And then, in fact, something, the point that should be made right at the top is that Morsi is in a nasty position, because the reason he grabbed power is not because he wants to be another pharaoh, but because so many of Mubarak's old cronies are still in the government. Who appointed all those judges? Not the Muslim Brotherhood. So the judiciary, the police, I mean, they replaced a lot of people, but it's the same situation you had in Iraq. The reason you got rid of the army and the police force was because they were all Sunnis working for Saddam. You couldn't keep them in power. They'd be against you. They'd say whatever you wanted to hear and basically, you know, shoot at you when your back was turned. This is the problem. And we pointed this out from day one, you know, in strategy page, that just getting Mubarak to resign and getting his, you know, his closest and most senior aides to go with him didn't replace this enormous bureaucracy, hundreds of thousands of officials who basically owe their jobs to Mubarak and all that corrupt cabal of businessmen and political characters who basically have been plundering Egypt for decades. They're still there, and they don't want to leave. So what are you going to do? Morsi's got a very difficult situation with this.
Well, see, here's why what he did was wrong and overplaying his hand. He had agreed, and he had committed himself personally and politically, at least to his coalition partners and to other revolutionaries, the secular revolutionaries, that he was going to play by the rules. Egypt was going to be a state with rule of law, not rule of the whim. And whether his frustration with the embedded functionaries that Jim just described led him to do it, or whether it's not so secretive radical Islamist and intends to create Tehran on the Nile, he chose to act in the way he did, which undermined his personal credibility, really, with virtually everyone, but didn't undermine his personal credibility with the most extreme elements of the Muslim Brotherhood. I don't mean that, but with segments of the revolutionary groups in Egypt that wanted change to something better, more open, more honest, and dare I also say more productive, because of the constant gripe about economic stagnation and corruption. And what he's done, though, is use the tool of the corrupt, aggressively outside of the law, or outside of the process of the law, acting on what is perceived as his own behalf. So now he's got this problem. Why did he do it now? Well, I don't think the world is tied up and focused on Gaza. My guess, and you know, there are a few strands of this out there on the web. This is my speculation based on what I read was that we've got a war on our border. It's the Israelis with a Muslim force. He's seeing this as a Muslim that he is, a member of the Muslim Brotherhood. I have the political opportunity to, let's say, as voting is what Jim suggested, to remove some of the cronies, Mubarak cronies, that are still in the government and block modernizing, democratizing initiatives that I'll bring about. Well, he misread that completely. It may be, and this is something that would emerge over time, but here's a bit of speculation on it. It may be that a great majority of the Egyptians really don't care about Hamas and Gaza. But what they care about is Egypt, economic opportunity in Egypt, and to some degree, their own personal freedoms in Egypt, far more than they give any credence to solidarity with the Palestinian cause. And I think there's some really good evidence that exists. And what's happened is you see the tens of thousands. I read the other day there were 200,000 people in Tahrir Square. That's not 400,000, it's 200,000. That's a lot of people, Dan. And they are angry. They feel that they have been betrayed. And what they've done, what Morsi's done, is actually give some of his, some of the Mubarak cronies, whether they're in the military or other places, an opportunity to make common cause with the secular revolutionaries. I don't think he wanted to do that. I don't think he thought this through. Now, he may surprise me and show that he's got, he's got the move wired, and he's got the support, and the support of whatever that a core of his Muslim Brotherhood supporters is the source of power in Egypt. If that's the case, that's bad news for Egypt, in terms of making the kind of economic strides. They don't need ideological strides. They need economic success. I think that's bad news. More chaos visited on Egypt. And again, I gave you the reason that I think he acted when he did.
Yes. What's your take on Morsi, Jim?
Well, he's in a very difficult position. People expect him to change things, and he can't because he has no real power over the economic. You know, the economy is basically controlled by the military and a small number of family-owned, corporations, as it were, holding companies. It's always been that way in Egypt, for thousands of years. And they had a very cozy relationship with Mubarak, and now that's gone. And they want it back. And these entities, the military controls, a large chunk of not only the economy, but a lot of the population, not just the professional soldiers, but their families. And the army owns companies and what have you, so they have employees and what have you. They have a fairly large number of people they could put on the street, which they appear to be doing, as demonstrators, not as soldiers. And of course, the people who are running the economy, things aren't going too well right now. The tourism is way down, and the economy was never very efficient to begin with because it was basically, phony capitalism, for want of a better term. It wasn't how effective you were, but who you knew that determined, what kind of contracts you would get or what kind of permissions you would get to, go into this business or that business. That's very common throughout the Middle East and many parts of the world. So these guys have every interest, this group, the Mubarak supporters, for want of a better term, they have every interest in deposing Morsi and his Muslim Brotherhood or any reform government. Because reform means it's bad for their business. The fact that it's good for most Egyptians is irrelevant. These people are looking after their own interests, and their interests do not coincide with Mr. Morsi's at all. And that's a problem that they may never resolve. I mean, the revolution may just die in its before it even, gets on its feet, simply because they haven't got the money, they haven't got the broad enough support, to actually, run a country. It goes back to the old saying, be careful what you ask for, you might get it.
Well, Jim gives a far more positive view of Morsi's action than I do, but where we both agree is that the divisions are exposed. And
well, no, it was wrong. I mean, what he was doing was sometimes ecstatic. But the fact of the matter is, how many options has he got? They've been trying to get rid of these guys. But they have the laws that are in place. They're supposed to be forming a new constitution, but that's going to take a long time. And in the meantime, people want to be fed. People want jobs, and they're not getting it. And of course, the they can afford to basically ride out a long period of economic stagnation, but that's not the case with most Egyptians.
Yeah. Well, it seems to be a complicated issue there, and I don't think it's playing out as everybody thought it would,
it's not that complicated. That's the problem. It's basically, as I told a room full of CIA, new CIA analysts some years ago, follow the money. Money is the root of not just evil, but all sorts of stuff. We think in general, but we live in detail. And most people worry about, especially in very poor countries like Egypt, am I going to eat today? Am I going to have a roof over my head? I've got hungry children. People have very basic problems. And, when a bad economy gets worse, your problem is not complicated. It's how do we get things moving? I mean, it's like what happened in the United States 4 years ago. You went from what, 4% unemployment to 8%, 9%, 10% unemployment. And, it's not as bad as in Egypt, but obviously it got everybody's attention. And it became a number one, political issue. And that's what Morsi's facing, but he hasn't got the tools that Obama has or any head of state in a Western country. The economy was weak to begin with. And, he basically hasn't got many, tools in his toolbox. That's why people pointed out correctly that he basically helped us with Hamas because he didn't want that American money cut off. Apparently, our diplomats are very blunt. Play ball with us here, or that $2 billion a year disappears. That's very important, in the Egyptian running the Egyptian government. Not just that most of it goes to the military, but the fact that it's basically most of it goes to Egyptians.
Well, one last point about it, though. He did sacrifice one political tool he had, Jim, which was that he was going to be different. He wasn't going to be he wasn't going to be a pharaoh. He wasn't going to be Mubarak. He wasn't going to
exactly. And then he ends up, as you say,
he had no choices. But the thing is, though, that by the choice that he took, he lost that, and that's why he faces 200,000 people in the street. So. Let's pick this up again, Dan, about this topic, maybe at the first of next year, once we hit the first annual review of Arab Spring 2011. Second year that would be our first annual review, I suppose, since we sit there and review it in January. Let's see what's transpired over the 2.5 months. We'll pick it up on Egypt again.
Okay.
All right.
Jim, did you have something to say?
No, we're good.
Okay.
Well, that's fine.
Well, we'll wrap it up there, guys, and thank you.
Take care. Bye.